Okay, what is your full name?
It's John Richard Gray.
And where do you live?
I live at Hilgard, Oregon.
And where were you born, John?
I was born on 1410 Court Street in La Grande, Oregon on November the 30th of 1925.
And how come your family came to Union County?
Well, my mother originally lived in Baker, and I think possibly that's where my dad probably met her, and he was a railroader at the time. She was quite young. See, I think she was 13 and a half years old. And my dad originally came from over out of the Dells, what they call the Juniper Flat Country. And he rode horses and broke horses and rode in rodeos and done all that kind of a thing, but he didn't really like it over there too well. And he was out on his own, of course, ever since he was, I think, about 12 years old. He was gone. And he evidently came over to Union County and was working on the railroad over here.
Uh-huh. And then you moved from La Grande to Hilgard.
We moved from La Grande to Hilgard. We got into Hilgard around April of 1932.
Uh-huh. And living in a little community like that, did you have electric lights at that time?
At that time, we did not have any electric lights. We didn't have any running water. I know the outside privy was about probably 50 yards from the house. We burnt wood for our heating, and I did live in just a log house, so it was a good and warm house.
How did you get your water, from a spring?
We got the water from a spring, but we had what's called the old pitcher pump, and that's the way we pumped that. And it did come into the house.
Uh-huh. And you were how old when you moved
there? When we moved there, I would have been, I think, 6 years old.
Right.
Right, to start school. Getting close to 70. Yeah.
The school that you went to, was that the school that's there today?
That was the school at Hilgard. That's the old schoolhouse is still there. That was school district number 22. And I went to first grade there, and that was not the first time I'd gone to school, though. I went there, and Mrs. Whiting was a teacher there at that time. But prior to that, I had gone to school in Duncan, Oregon, that's on the railroad. And I went to school at Greenwood School in La Grande, and I had gone to school. Well, of course, I was just 5 years old, and I didn't pass because I was really too young, but I went the year, or part of the year at least, in 1930 at Perry, at Perry.
Uh-huh. Now, your school in Hilgard, was that a 1 through 8 in one room, or did they have it divided?
Yeah, the school at Hilgard's a one-room school, and it was from the first grade to the eighth grade.
Uh-huh. As you were growing up, you remember the CCC camp being up there at the Starkey Turnoff.
Yes, I remember that CCC camp. We used to go up there. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was every Saturday they showed a movie up there. And all of us kids or whoever wanted to go up could go up to that movie, and they served punch and cookies, and we have to watch the movie.
Well, that was a good deal. Yeah. Not living in town, it was Depression time.
That's right, otherwise we'd have never probably got to go to the movie.
Well, I can appreciate that. Now, did you ever have a little money to go down to the store there at Five Points?
Well, once in a while we'd get a few cents. Most of the time, to get a few cents to go down and buy something, we went around and picked up pop bottles. And you could get a penny apiece for them if you could find them, you didn't find too many. And then we could go down and buy a little candy or maybe a pop or something like that. Not too often.
How many kids were living in Hilgard about that time?
Well, during some of that time, I may have some school records, a few of them on that, but I think possibly you'd find they range from going to school there probably about 23 to 30.
That made quite a bunch.
Yeah, it was quite a little place then.
Then you say in the evening when you had time, you played games. What kind of games did you play?
Oh, yeah, in the winter time we was out trying to ski. The only time we ski is when we could find some old barrel staves, I guess you'd call it that, from the wooden barrels, and make skis out of them and come down the hill. And then we had sleds, and we played with those, and on the hills right there. Summertime, I don't know, most of the time in the summertime, we like to go fishing with a creek right there. So we spent our time fishing.
And you were successful?
Oh, boy, I'll tell you, fishing was good that day and age. We had allowed 30 fish. You didn't have to go, I wouldn't think, over 200 or 300 yards. You could have your 30 fish, and I mean, they was nice ones then.
Nice. Well, when you said making your own toys, that's the way you didn't have money to go to stores.
No, didn't have money to go down like you do nowadays. We just kind of made do with what you had.
What were some of the toys that you made besides skis during the wintertime?
Well, in the summertime, we get an old barrel sometimes, and I used to remember that. Get an old barrel and put ashes and stuff like that in it, and make it look like we had an engine going down the road, and we'd get in there and take a stick and hit the inside of that barrel, and all the ashes would come flying out there, and they looked like an old smoke stack on a steam engine coming, and of course we did too, but then that's the way we done that. I think we done that mostly when Dewey and Louis Kling lived there at that time.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's who is with my brother and me.
Yeah. Well, besides playing around when you were doing that, I'm sure you had a lot of chores to do. What kind of chores did you have?
Well, we had every night, especially, we had to go get the cows. My dad milked cows, and they'd be clear back on the mountain somewhere. And we'd take the old dog, and we'd head back every night going find those cows, and it was quite a ways. And at times we had to help get the wood in, cut the wood. And of course, in the summertime, we didn't have a lawn, so we had pine trees and fir trees, so we had to rake the needles up and dispose of those. And I don't know, we just about everything like that. Sometimes we'd go up there, and later on, as time went, we got a little bigger, we'd go up and cut some wood, mm-hmm. and bring that down off the hill. So I think that, I'm not saying that's all of it, but then that's some of the things we've done.
Well, was it a real treat when you got to go to town?
Yeah, quite so, but sometimes I didn't even want to go to town because I like to fish, and I'd rather fish than go to town. And sometimes I'd be up there, like in the summertime when we weren't going to school, I might go to town maybe a couple of times that summer. I'd rather go up, stay up there and fish.
Well, you had so many places to fish, Five Points Creek, and yeah. Grand Round River.
Yeah, the fishing was really good because the Five Points Creek there, the trout was just, there was a lot of trout in there. It run more water, I think, than it does now, quite a lot. Steelhead came up, salmon came up there. So, you know, and it was just all this fishing and all the game, deer, lots of deer then, a lot of deer.
When did you get your first gun?
I got my first gun when I turned 6 years old. I got a .22 single shot bolt action rifle I think they called it a Springfielder, I believe.
Uh-huh. Then when did you get your own deer rifle? So,
my first deer rifle, I think that's when I had a .22 special, 1890 .22 special, and that's what I used for a deer rifle that day. I probably wasn't over 8 years old, 9 years old when I had that.
Got your first deer.
When I hunt, and I don't remember. I possibly got my first deer when, I don't imagine I got that until I was probably about 12 years old or 13. Then I killed my sheriff and sent, so.
And elk.
And elk. I've got, I will say I've got a lot of elk in that country up there. Not so many later here in years. The elk is not near as good of, not as many elk. And it's a harder hunt. And of course, we used to hunt all day. I and my brother and my dad. And we may see one other person. And we'd be back above Five Points Canyon. But now you go back there and it's different.
Well, there just aren't as much game in that area as there were.
No. No, we were up there the other day and looked, and we probably seen close to 100 head elk in one bunch. But they're concentrated now. But then you go up there in hunting season now, and you don't hear them bugling like they used to. You used to hear them bugle all around you, the bulls.
Well, it's probably made some difference of that land across from you there that is owned by Sherman, where it's swapped up and you hunt by permit only.
That's true. And there is elk there. I just talked to a game commission the other day, 2 days ago, and they said that they went flying over there and they counted 400 or 4,000 and some elk up there. And I don't suppose they've seen them all. And that seems like that they're a feed in there, that it's the elk just hang in there.
Yeah.
And they don't come out on some of this other. But there is an awful lot of hunters now, tremendous amount.
Well, we probably have seen the best of.
I've seen the best of all the hunting. And not saying that there isn't some up there, but of course they've changed the seasons around. It's just not like it used to be. Now we've got turkeys now. Uh-huh. And that's why I was down the game commission the other day talking to them, because the turkeys are making my place look bad. Maybe got 80 to 100 turkeys right in my yard. And you know what happens.
Quite messy.
And they've already caused me to have to call a guy that has a carpet business here to come up and fix one of my carpets, or fix a carpet in the living room. And we just put that thing in here. It hasn't been, I don't think, three months ago.
I've heard of other places in the valley here that they have
so,
the same problem.
Yeah, I went down and seen them about that, and they said it's too narrow up there at Hillgard to trap them, you know, net them, because they can't net them in there. The guy was up there and talked to me, one of the fellows, and so he gave me a couple of boxes of 12-gun shotgun shells, 12 gauge, and told me to shoot and scare them and see if they do. So I tried that, and I scare them up, but I don't know, they must like them there, they come back. They, most of the time, they scare them my neighbor's place instead.
When you graduated from the 8th grade, then that's when you had to go into the Grand, and there wasn't any school buses at that time. How did you...
No school buses at that time. At that time, we had to drive our own self in. My dad brought us in. He was able to bring us in, and then at the times he couldn't, we used to the car. Of course, you only had one car.
Well, as soon as you were able to drive legally...
Yeah. Well, it's actually my brother was older than I was, he's 17 and a half months older than I was, so he could drive, and then, of course, you could get a permit at 14 to drive in here at that time. Uh-huh. Well, what happened, he stayed out of school 1 year, because he was 1 year in advance from me, and he stayed out 1 year so that we'd both go to the same grade, you know, the same time. Uh-huh. And he drove us in and back whenever we did.
When you moved into town after going to, you might say, a country school or a small school like that, did you find it hard to be in town with all the students compared to just a few?
Very true. I found that it was pretty hard to go, and quite a few Well, different ones, and I really didn't know very many. Because of the school I went to, there were just, you know, some of them there, of course, would still remain going up there, the ones under me. And a few of them I did know. But I found out the hard part was that a lot of things that they was further advanced in here at school in McGrand. And so it was hard for me to catch up, real hard.
About what year did you start coming into as a freshman?
Probably in 1940.
What, at that time, what was going on in the community and world affairs affecting this area? Think of anything?
I didn't know a lot about LeGrand at that time. In fact, like I keep telling my wife, living up there at Hillgard, we was almost kind of, at that day and age, you might say we were just kind of hid back from anybody else. We didn't really know what was going on. But for the simple reason, not having electricity or anything like that, we had a radio, but when the that radio we had took the 3 or 4 batteries. And that when it lasts so long, when it run out of battery, we didn't have any radio then.
Uh-huh.
So we done without a radio, we didn't have anything.
So the things that were going happening around, you didn't know.
We were really isolated, and we didn't have a telephone. We didn't have anything.
Yeah. Now, when the war started, Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941, what was the biggest change you saw immediately?
I think the biggest things we've seen that I remember as a kid, that we was driving then, and we had a car, and we heard gas was going to be rationed and everything pretty soon, so we went down and filled the cars off full of gas. We had a separate old gas tank, went down and put gas in that. And gas didn't cost too much then if you had the money to buy it. And we did find out, as to start with, they asked for everybody to turn any old tires they had in. We gathered up all of our old tires and took them down, turned them in. And I don't know, we just couldn't, after a while, of course they rationed gas, you know, in there, and we had to have some gas stamps. And there was a lot of changes, all that. But I went in the service here later on, you know, and I didn't notice so much then.
But when it first started, did you feel the pressure that it looked like you were going to go in the service?
Oh, I knew. I knew.
And you felt that that changed your life considerably, made it a little harder on you?
Well, probably, except that I was going to go in and whip the Japs myself if nobody else would, you know. I mean, that was about my thought to then. I was one to go in.
Yeah.
And so my brother went in ahead of me. He went in the Navy. And but I wanted to get in there. And to start with, I was turned down. And then I got called in again and on the thing. And so that time I made it. But there was, it did change things, because I see up above Hillgard some B-38s come in there, and they started to diving around and so on, which draws your attention that what they were doing, probably practicing. But it brought it kind of down where you knew something really was going on, you know.
Your dad was a section foreman at that time.
My dad at that time was, he went to work for Mount Emily.
Oh.
Mount Emily. He was up there and went to work at what's called the Jack Camp. And he could be one of the fellows that's on the motor car there, I don't know. Because he was up in there at that time. And that's where he worked until he retired.
Well, it seems that at times people got funny ideas that the Japanese that had been around went back to Japan and they were going to be saboteurs. And
well, I can even relate to a little of that. When I worked, I worked at the Jap camp too before I went to service. And I worked with Ann Kersu, which was an old country born Jap, and he was the one that some soldier boy took between LeGrand and Baker somewhere in that neighborhood, took him behind a gravel pit. He gave a ride to him. He was going to, I don't know where he's heading for, Ontario or somewhere, and he wasn't supposed to, though. He was supposed to not go any further than LeGrand from the Jap camp back and forth, so they left him here. He didn't bother anything. But he decided he was going further, and he picked up this soldier, and the soldier took him behind a gravel pit and killed him. And I got along real good with him. He was a pretty good guy. And then the other three up there was Queechee Yamasaki, Irvin Yamasaki, and Tom Yamasaki. All three of those guys went in and to the war, but they went in on fighting the Germans on their
European
side.
Theater.
I knew every one of those there.
Really, they were very nice people.
Good.
People had ideas that were completely wrong.
Yeah. Truthfully, you're right on that. These guys, it was all good guys, good workers and everything. But at the time, what they told us at the time, now I don't know truth about all of this, but they was put, a lot of them, into concentration camps, it said, for their protection, where that people wouldn't kill them because they, you know, when the war comes on, you're looking at that particular type of people, whoever you're fighting, you're looking at them, not looking at them very good.
Well, it was too bad about that one that was killed.
Yeah.
Heard about it, but I didn't know the details.
I'm kind of sorry at, a lot of times I'd get letters when I was in the service, and not from him, but him telling my folks to write, and then he did write, or did have them to ask me if I was mad at him because he was a Jap, and then I wrote back, and I said, no, I said, I'm not mad at him. I said, this is nothing personal. That's what I wrote.
Out of LeGrand, they had guards on some of the bridges.
Yes, they did.
Did they have some of the upper bridges?
Well, you're probably right, and I don't recall who all was here. I think it might have been Louis Greeno, might have been I'm not sure whether he was a guard or not, but they did have bridges, guards on them, some of the places up here. I don't know which one, because prior to that, I'd been over working then for the Union Pacific Railroad, and I was over at Portland, and what they call the steel bridge there, that's a big long bridge, they did have a guard there, and I got well acquainted with him, because I worked there at that time too. I worked for Davenport, signal maintainer there, working the railroad with him.
Well, it could have been bad, because if they would have sabotaged the railroad here, they'd have tied up the traffic clear across the United States.
Yeah. And it would have been, it would have been real bad. This day and age we're in now, it could happen. That day and age we were more isolated, this country's, so we weren't it wasn't as apt to that to happen then, like it would be now.
When we had the flood in 1965, a lot of people back in Omaha didn't even know that you couldn't drive to all parts of the railroad.
I remember that well, because they had us, they had me up here at Perry, it washed out right there at Perry, and they called me, and everybody was doing everything they could to try to stop everything, but the track was washing up. They had me to get a load of ties in a truck, in a flatbed truck, and take up there one evening, and I was backing up, and the water was coming down, and the next thing I looked behind, and the road was caving in right behind me. And, man, I put that thing in gear and took off going forward, and it was caving in as I went, but I got out of there, and I made it out, which otherwise it would have been down in the river.
A number of railroad cars went down in the river.
Yes, and they did put some in on their south too.
Oh.
That was the only way they could get it blocked off. They sent me out later out to Island City at that bridge, that crosses right there at Iowa City. And wanted me to go out there and watch that one, so I watched it for a while. I was by myself. I come back in. I said, ain't nothing I can do. I said, you don't can't send a train there. Washed out on one end right there. There's nothing you could do.
That's the one when the gable end of Lovely's house hit it.
Yeah,
that's when it washed out.
That washed that part out. And let's see, there was several places that was washing there. I know that. I can't remember. There was another time, I guess, when I was up the branch up towards Willow, that we got stuck up there because it was washing out, and I had to come back down. I did make it through. My boss, Gilbert Marlin, do you remember him? Probably, I don't know, but he was a roadmaster, and he was up there, and he set me down and to go to Huntington, and I went to Huntington, calling everybody out that I could call out on the railroad to get out there on the tracks and get all everything you could think of to work with, you know, because the thing it was wishing out all over at that time, and I can't remember that at the same time though.
Well, when you came back from the service, were you at a little loss at what to do? What did you think when you came?
When I came back from the service, of course, I was still a pretty young guy. And when we was in the service, we used to talk about, well, one thing about it, we didn't like what was at, we just quit. We couldn't do it in there while we was in the service. We knew that, so but that was a big thing. So I came home, I put that into practice. I quit. I'd get a job, and if I held a job for 3 or 4 months, I was doing pretty good. I'd quit. I'd been a long time that got on that job, but I'd get disgusted with it, and I'd quit. Finally, I hit a bad winter. In fact, I hit a couple of bad winters. No work, and one winter, I couldn't even find a job, except I sold everything. I didn't have a car, finally. I'd got rid of that, because just didn't have anything. And I had to walk from Hillgard to LeGrand. I was married by then. I walked from Hillgard to LeGrand, and I could maybe get a job and make a dollar. That's all. I had to end up had I, my wife, and one kid. And that's what we lived on, $1 a week. $1 a week. And lucky we was living in my folks' log house. So we had to burn green wood and everything else to get through the winter. It got 48 below zero up there that winter. It was cold, not a lot of snow. And, but I went through, well, another winter wasn't too good. Well, I got on the railroad, I stayed. After that, I had about all that I could handle on that. That taught me a lesson to, you get on there, you stay from there on. And I got for us. I was afraid to quit.
Well, you had a family.
That's it. I had the family then, and of course the oldest daughter was born after that, and then of course younger one later on, though, of course, time then.
Well, people don't know a lot about the section. What are the real important things that you're doing out there to make sure that train stays on the track?
Well, about everything you can think of. I'll tell you, people, and you're right, people see two rails and some ties out there that's hooked onto them, and they think that's it. But you're working under the engineering department, and you've not only got to have good rail, you've got to have decent ties, but you've got to keep that track, you've got to keep it in all your curves on that. You have your elevation in your curves according to the speed of the train that's going across that, and it all depends on whether going uphill and downhill. You got to, I imagine, have a probably figure out an average on that. But you've got your compounds on your curves. You've got to have your elevations, all your spirals. You've got to put in correct, and it's a lot more than just looking at. Nowadays they've got machines that you can set them, the electronic, they can do this for you.
Now, you said a compound and a spiral. Could
yes.
you explain what that is?
Well, you curve, you go around a curve, you say a curve that's, I'll just use one that's probably 400 feet long. I don't know. That's just kind of a guess. But anyway, when you come onto that curve, if it's a, oh, let's say it's a 5-degree curve, then you're going to, you got to raise your elevation up, and it raises up there so many, well, say a half inch to ever 30 feet until you hit the full elevation, which you may be, say, 3.5 inches. We'll just use that. And then you'll maintain that 3.5 through the full body. Now, this is all on the spiral to start with, where you raise your elevation. And then when you get to the full body of the curve, it will keep that 3.5 inches until you get to the other end. Then it's got to come back down. So in that spiral, you come back down at, a, like, say, a half inch to every 30 feet. And it can vary a little bit there. The compound, when you go around that, you may go to the spiral on one end, bring it up to full elevation, and then you go around for compounds again, then you got to, it's got to come up again in that full body a little bit. And then go back down and come back down and then go on down.
And all the time maintaining that same distance between the wheels.
So, and you've got to have that, you've got to have your right...
To run through the gauge.
Yeah, you have to have the, your gauge there. And it's you have to maintain your gauge within a certain tolerance all the time. And that's got to be maintained throughout the whole curve, and of course on the straight track also.
It, while you were out there working on the track, I think we mentioned earlier that you had to keep in touch with the dispatcher to know where the trains were going to be at all time and how long you could be on the line, or if you had a particular problem, to get out of the problem so that the train could go through without them having a problem.
Yes, but before you start on the job out there where you render that track unsafe, you have to either, years ago you put flags up and then recorded that. Now you call the dispatcher and you get a certain amount of time on that track, whatever he'll allow you, and that's your track for that length of time, but it better be back together at the end of that time and be passable by trains at, without any well, back in good condition, in other words. And if you do have to keep it longer, well, sometimes something will happen and you can't give it back, of course. If that's not appreciated very much, so you try to do it, you know. But at times, something will happen. But that's the general procedure, and it changed a little since then. Now they've got what they call, well, it, we had red yellow boards later that you had to put up, and when the train comes to that, they cannot go into that area until you release it.
Railroad's very strict. If there's an accident or something happened out there, they look out and they fire everybody in sight, and then they decide who was at fault.
Yeah, it's occasionally something will happen, but then it can be really technical on that, because you can get fired quite pretty easy, you know, on that. I've pulled out of service twice, and... But actually what you get pulled out. Or, you know, I had 30 days one time and 60 another. Mm-hmm. And both times, though, I will say, the railroad was real good. Some of the officials come and saw me at my house, and they told me, said, well, we didn't see anything too bad what you done ourselves, you know, from what they could see. And but the union didn't help me a bit.
Trainmen had job insurance.
I had job insurance when I was on there.
On your part also?
You bet I did. I kept job insurance on. I collected that. In fact, the time they pulled me out for 2 months, I told them, I said, it made me feel so bad, I went out and bought me a brand new automobile.
Well, it's an interesting way to do business sometimes.
Well, you know, I didn't I really didn't feel it. And of course, like I say, one of the officials is back in Omaha, Nebraska right now. He's high up. He come up to my house and he said, well, he said, I don't really see anything so bad that you, he didn't even figure I should have got pulled out. But then that's the way it happened, and they called me back.
When you were working as a section foreman, how long was your district?
Well, let's see. I'll give you the last one I had. Of course, we had various times, but mine run from when I, well, the last place I was at was LeGrand. I run the section here in LeGrand. And before that, Hillgard, and before that, Camila. Well, the one at LeGrand came from about the east, on this side of LeGrand, that would, let's see, that'd be about, can't remember the milepost. But from LeGrand, anyway, to Motanic. And I can't remember the vote. Been a while since I've been on that. I can't remember the milepost of those right now. But I would say that probably about 12, 15 miles in a way, in length. Plus you have double track on some of it and sidings. And I had the yards here in LeGrand too on top of that.
Well, you lived out at Hillgard. You feel that that was an advantage of having that district, because then there were, like, if you had, was, how far did Camila run? Did it go down to Duncan?
Camila, no. When I was there, Camila at that time went from Motanic. It went from East Motanic, let's see, to, I believe, about East Meacham, right close to East Meacham, didn't quite make that. And they had a lot of double track up there and a center track too in that. That was a center sighting.
Well, that area from Meacham down through Duncan and Huron and down there, that's pretty inaccessible.
Well,
other than by rail.
You can get to it now. Yeah. But there's a road in now. It's not what you'd call a good road. And it's a tough one in the wintertime.
Yeah.
But you can get through there. You can go all the way to Gibbon now that way and come right out.
Yeah. I have been down there for
years. Yeah, you can go all the way through that. I used to take care of, when I was up at Camila, I had machinery and we worked day and night up there in the wintertime. And a lot of times I was off my section, on it and off in it both. And I would leave. I may never get back. I'd leave maybe sometime that day after going to work that morning, and I would go down and almost to Gibbon, and I may not get back until the next day. And we'd be down there for plowing snow. We'd plow snow, and then a lot of times I'd come clear to Hillgard doing that. I'd be on my section and both adjoining sections.
You'd be working all the time because there wasn't any motel or hotel or something to stay in.
Well, we were working a lot like that, and lots of hours, because the roadmaster, hadn't been on long. This was a new one that came up, and he said, I want to go with you guys down the track, he said, and see what you're doing there. Come on, we had a machine, see. And I had other men working out, and I left them, but they knew what to do. And we took off, and when we got back, it was the next morning, and he said, see if I ever go with you guys anymore. He said, I'm never going to you guys again. It was good money, but it was a lot of hours. Lots of hours. I've had one fellow, he runs a Broadway garage. It's an old garage there in Baker. He worked with me. He got a 1 hour sleep one night, and not good at that. He would run. I had machine operators of all kinds up there at that time. But we'd done a lot of work in there.
Well, in those old days, you had to put heaters under switches.
Years ago, I worked up there for Dick Holcomb. He was a section foreman. I came work for him one time, and we had for the what we call the pots, you know, you put under them, you fill them full of, I believe that's kerosene or whatever you could put in. I think it's kerosene or number one diesel. That put them in there, and they would, you had to clean them all the time. You put them in and let them run. You had to keep them filled up and cleaned out. Because half the time, there was, the wind would blow them out, train come by.
Didn't dare get that on your gloves or on your shoes because you would get frosted.
Yes, and later on, they put heaters under them, propane heaters, and trains would come by, and those things would set the ties on fire a lot. And then it would be pure ice out there and cold as the dickens, and everything froze down, and you had to chip them old ties out and put new ties under. And the only lights you had most of the time was what they call a call light setting on the signal house there. And if you was right there where it showed a little light, that's all you could see at night, and you was out there working.
I noticed up in the Hill Guard area they put a number of concrete ties up there.
Now this,
how did that work out?
That's evidently working out pretty good. Now that came just as I retired. They was putting those in, and if I understand that as long as they keep them tamped up good and good ballast to the rock under there, that they're all right. But if they get them, let them get down, it'll put an abrasion on them ties, like, and it they'll just cut them to pieces.
Well, right pretty close to your house there, I noticed on a few ties, the concrete ones, that there were some deep gouges in the center of the ties there.
Well, they do come down too in there. They come down like they come kind of concaved in there, son.
But these look like a piece of metal that chipped a groove, right? You suppose something has come loose?
Well, that's possible. Now there's there's a big steel plate inside that.
Oh.
Also, inside that thing, and so that's to, I suppose, to reinforce it too.
I didn't know whether the drawbar hit it. Or,
it's possible, but it really haven't had much troubles up there for a long time.
Yeah.
And there's no spikes anymore because they use what they call a clip that goes in there. It's kind of like a wedge. You just wedge everything in there.
Well, one day I know I talked to you, it's been 4 or 5 years ago. I was up taking pictures east of your house there where it goes through Hillgard.
Oh, yeah.
I was curious about that scene.
Yeah, it's they've upgraded a lot now, and then of course they have their tampers. They go out there and tamp with now. It's not handwork like we used to do. It used to be handwork, you know, and we had what we call the idiot stick, you know, that's what you tamp with, or a shovel. But shovels was kind of done away with mostly. But it was the tamping bars, and no matter what you've done out there, you couldn't go too far in a day doing that, and it just wasn't like it is now. And then because they had all jointed rail then.
Yeah.
With jointed rail, every joint would start battering, and then they kick a service bend on them. You couldn't get them, they wouldn't straighten up then. But now they're a CWR rail on there now, quarter mile steel.
A quarter of a mile. Rail put in.
Yeah, and then they weld them. They weld them after we've unloaded that quarter mile rail, you know, and you just hook onto the existing track and you put a cable around it and you pull it off.
I've seen some of these trains with those rails on there, and that's really something when you think that they go around curves. And
all around there, and that's real limber. That rail, with the length of it like that, is limber. And it's dangerous work. It's real, real dangerous work, all of that. That stuff, I've seen those engines start, when they're loading it, even to me, that was worse. When they start loading some rail, they start pushing to bring it in, you know, and it just comes up on the rollers. And if it hangs up any, that's just like pushing a wet noodle and just bend that stuff and break it all around. Worked with that some quite a bit there, and then of course derailments, you know, there used to be lots and lots of derailments, and I've spent days and days on derailments, you know, and nights just working just for seemed like forever on them, you know. I know down at Huron, East Huron, I built a switch down there, put a switch in after they had a derailment on it. And I just got it all, and I had other guys, I was in charge of them. And we had several crews up there. We got the switch all back together, everything fine. Went home, turned right around, and something come through and derailed again. Tore them out again. So that they tore switches out up and down there for a few years. We was running on derailments all the time. Yeah. And now there's nothing bad at all. They've been pretty good on it. But I think it's this new CWR rail and concrete ties. And it's a lot better material now.
Then they have that rail car that comes along and checks the rail.
They have the rail car. They used to bring it on quite a bit. I've been retired for a while, but they still do. And they have a car that it checks for the defects in the rail. And then they've got another one that comes through and can travel right along and tell you all the gauge, what the gauge actually is. And it tells, and it sets, and it gives, it can set down the mile post and everything.
Gauge, would you explain that?
That's the width between the two rails.
Uh-huh.
For the flange fits. Mm-hmm. But they'll come through, and they can travel right along, and I suppose the best word to say it's probably more like computer, because when they find a spot that will say that needs corrected, it'll show that right there on that milepost where it's at. So you'll get a copy that'll come out from that thing, and then you can look at that, and you can go trace that down.
Right.
It'd be out there working on derailments, and it'd be a kind of a snow and rain, little sleet like, and you'd be so wet and cold, and it just right down, you'd feel the water trickling down your legs and everything, your gloves were all wet. And I had men out there that I had to keep busy, and we had to keep things going to get this back together, because we had to run trains. And it'd be out there the way all night long working, and you just couldn't get colder. And that's how come I really appreciate being able to stay on the side now when it gets colder, because it was really so bad. And I have spent many a night out, and well, in days too, but you know, cold weather bad. Summertime wasn't so bad, but the winter, it's terrible.
Well, I worked for Harry Hewitt up there at Telecasset, putting heaters in their switches at Sago at 35 below zero.
You bet. Wind could be a howling, you know, going. And it was bad. And, well, even bad when I was track inspector. Now, I didn't have to do some of the work like that, because most of mine was traveling. But I'd go across this mountain on a motor car. And I had a top on it, but I didn't have any sides or no heaters or anything. I took a fellow over there one time. He was inspecting switches. He had to go through, sent out from Omaha. And lucky there was a little shanty down what they call Ross down below Camila. I stopped there, and I went in, and I set off, and we couldn't even see the railroad. It was snow all over it. We were still able to go for some reason. Cold, I tell you, terrible. And we went in there and I built a fire. I don't think that fellow would have made it. He was so cold and so froze. Well, we finally got down to Gibbon, and the roadmaster, he came along and brought another guy out and relieved us, because the weather was so bad that it was freezing out there. And I was dressed pretty good for it myself.
Yeah.
The other fellow wasn't too well.
Didn't know what it takes to do a job like that.
Yeah, and I used to run that. I used to run the track from Le Grand to Huntington 1 week, and from Le Grand to Hinkle the next week. And that was the way I went every week. And then up the branch, up the Pilot Rock branch, and then up to the Joseph branch. And all that had to come in under this time, you know, winter or summer. It was kind of rough. I never really liked that job so well after I'd been on it for a while, because you know it's better if you're out there. If you can do a little work, stay warm, and it's otherwise it's kind of bad. But I've seen a lot of that high water, lots of high water. I've got a few pictures of high water up on the Joseph Ranch, and that was probably in about 1957 or 58, somewhere in there, when the track washed out.
Well, it'd be very helpful on this interview if you did have a picture showing a particular area that you've discussed.
Yeah.
And I will show you in some of the interviews that we've done how it enhances the what we're talking about.
Yeah, I'll see if I can
showing a picture.
I'll see if I can find some of that stuff. I'm not a very good photographer, so you probably won't see it like it should have been done, but I did get a picture or two of a spot or two, you know, around. And I've been on that track when we've had a few runaways, too. Not to my, one time we had a runaway from Camila, let's see, we got on the track at Camila with a track tamper. It was a service, to service the track. And anyway, for some reason, the brakes that they had a disc brake on them, and the travel on that wasn't taken up, or something happened to it. I don't know exactly what happened there, but we got to, and it was some of the first ones. We got coming down the track to come into Hillgard, all the way down off that mountain, and we got going along there, and the guy put the brakes on. The fellow was running it, and it didn't slow down.
And you were going down the track at a high rate of speed.
We were going down, and we were supposed to come in to Hillgard, then go into a house track, and there was some boxcars sitting on the house track. And we were coming down through there, and I told him, I said, well, I don't know, man. The machine we had wasn't noted to be hanging on that rail. And you weren't supposed to be able to run them very fast down there. And I imagine we was doing about 50 miles an hour. And we come down through there in the West Switchy Hillgard, they had it lined over for the passing track. And then on further down, if they was a hand throw, those guys would have a hand throw, someone that went ahead of us to put us in on the house track. And I was hoping, I told the guy, I said, boy, I sure hope we get that. We'll never make that switch at this speed. But we did. I don't know how it happened, but we made that switch and got through it, just right on through that thing, and got on down. And I said, you know, I said, I hollered at him because that's the only way, because it was pretty noisy. And I said, if they've got that hand thrown into that boxcar, I said, we're going to have to jump. I said, that'll kill us if we hit that boxcar. And we got down there, and some of my men were down there with the roadmaster at the switch. We started honking on the horn there, and I told him to start blowing that horn there. And he didn't know how to blow emergency for some reason. I don't know why. And so he's honking, and this roadmaster says, look at that. Said, them guys are, he said, they're playing. And this one guy that worked for me, he says, they're not playing, you darn fool. He said, those guys have a runaway. He said, throw that switch back. And the guy looked, and finally he threw the switch back before we got there, and we went right on by. We finally got stopped just down near the East Witchy Hillgard. We finally did get a stop because it leveled out down there. That was dangerous. But I've been on three or four or five runaways like that on the road track. Real bad.
Now, you mentioned house track.
Mm-hmm.
What is a house track?
That's a little track where they just store stuff.
Okay.
Where the old corrals where the cattle and sheep trails were at Hillgard, that's a house track. It's over near that, and they used to load cattle out there when they had the pens.
Well, that's for somebody that doesn't know what.
Yeah, they used to load there. Tony Bays used to load cattle there a lot years ago, and I know that. Well, when I was going to school, they up there at Hillgard, they loaded cattle there. Then I don't know when they quit that. Of course, See, I owned that schoolhouse for several years. I bought that, you know.
Oh.
And I'd owned it for several years there. And I sold it to a guy named Pence.
And they're using it as a residence now.
Yeah, it's, yeah, Tom Mahoney owns that now. Yeah. Yeah, he's got that. But I bought several places there, two or three places there, Hilgard, you know, one time. I rented them. Bought here in LeGrand, and I think I bought three houses here in LeGrand. Bought one on Oak and one on N Avenue, and the last one down on Y. And it's still down there. My daughter, youngest daughter, got it. I get tired of it. I give it to her. I told her she could have that one because I didn't want to mess with the thing, you know. Okay. But, yeah, I don't know. Out there at Camila, we've had several times that we were pretty fortunate. Things, you know, you're working with heavy equipment, mm-hmm. and it's kind of dangerous at times, especially in the winter, you know.
I can appreciate that.
I know that I was cleaning a switch there one time myself. I had men other places, and it was at nighttime, and I wasn't what we call the center pass. There's one right in the center, two of the main lines on each side. And anyway, I was cleaning on at Nordine. Well, right there at the center, just on the other side of Nordine. And I thought the train was coming up the hill. And anyway, I thought he was coming up on the main track, you know. But some way that they threw that switch down at Nordine, they come in on where I was at. And I had my flashlight sitting there on the rail. And next thing I know, he's right there, right near me, you know, and it was dark, and I was noisy anyway, you know, around in there, it seemed like. I jumped out, and the guy told me later, I thought we'd got you.
I appreciate it.
But, you know, you're out there for hours and hours.
You can't stop one of those things.
No, they don't stop.
People don't understand that. That's why so many people get hit.
They do.
If they see you, they can't stop within a mile.
No, it's... I've been places there where they had derailments and somebody would say, well, why didn't they stop? And I said, they don't stop. In fact, over at Portland, we was working on a switch over there. Train come by and hit a woman with a car and killed her right there by us. And, you know, I don't know if she just didn't see the train, you know, and it would just, things can happen. And there wasn't a...
No, along those lines, I have a friend that was a railroad engineer who had an accident over there in Idaho, and there was a fatality in it, and this one town official came in. He says, can I look up in the cab? The engineer said, yes. He says, where's the steering wheel? He says, you don't have any steering wheel. You see those two rails out there? He says, oh, he says, you mean you couldn't have swerved and missed her?
Well, you know, a lot of people don't think about it, but you get up in an engine, and especially some of them, and you look down that track when you're going along and you're doing pretty good speed, east of LeGrand here, you're right out there rolling. That track, them rail down there look pretty small. They don't look very wide.
Yeah.
And you're going through there, then you watch and see people driving across in front of you on those crossings. And it really kind of gets you there, kind of makes you mad because you know that they're taking chances, you know. They'll drive right across in front of you, a lot of them.
Yeah.
They can't stop.
It really worries the trainmen.
Oh, yeah.
And,
it would bother you there. But I've been around this railroad for a lot of years. Well, ever since when I was born, my dad was working on the railroad. And I've been around it for a lot of years, and I've seen, you know, from like it was years ago. And it's, in some ways, it's way better now. In some ways, it's not as good. You know, working conditions, as far as the work nowadays, they go out there and they have to discuss what they're going to do for each job they do. If they quit this job and go to another, they got to have a little talk about that. And then they got to do their exercises. They got to do the exercise where they go to work in the morning, do their exercise after they have through lunch, you know, like we did in the service, you know, a little of that. And we used to, years ago, never do that, never have to tell anybody. Of course, the people pretty well know if you go out there and you got some old hands in there, you're going to do a certain job. They've done it 1,000 times, so they know. But now you've got to tell them. And so all this is done before you ever work, whether it takes you, no matter how long it takes you to do it.
Well, I appreciate that. We're living in Hilgard. What has done in the property value, say, in the last 40 years?
Well, I can give you a little clue on that. Of course, we moved there, like I say, in 1932, and there was a log house there, not too much of anything else, and a chicken house, pretty good size. My dad bought 30 acres up there at that one place at that time. He paid $500 for it. He sold his house here on 1410 Court Street for $250 on that one. But he bought this 30 acres and that house for $500. Well, now there's a A-frame on that house and a barn, a little barn. But there's only 8.5 acres on it because they'd sold off the other part. And with that they've got right now, it is for sale right now. $259,000, I think, is what they want for it.
Boy.
That's a slight difference in what it used to be. I think this one place, and I'm not positive, but I think this one was about 580 acres my dad had bought, or 83 acres, something like that. And I think he paid $1,400 for it. And that probably more within keeping, because all it is just grazing land, you know, and there was some timber on it, though. And timber is much more expensive today. But then I think that one time sold for $162,500, and it's sold a couple of times since, so normally they go up. It's hard to say what it is. That's one where the people build a new home up there. You've seen that
up on the hill.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's possible.
I'd wondered who that house was.
Yeah, that, you know the people, don't you? Chris down there that has Chris Colors out here that paint.
I know of the business,
yeah,
but
they
I
built
don't,
that.
Don't personally know.
Nice house, nice big home. Yeah. It's you put my home inside of it and can't find it.